Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with biographers about their work. This time, biographer Nicholas Boggs talks about his comprehensive examination of the life of writer James Baldwin. The biography, Baldwin, A Love Story, was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in August 2025. Nicholas Boggs was interviewed during Bio's annual conference in June of this year by Bio member Carolyn Van Putten.
I must ask you, Nicholas, to begin with, what drew you to James Baldwin as the subject matter of your first biography, and how did it evolve?
Well, it's appropriate to be asking this question in my hometown, Washington, D.C. I first saw James Baldwin's face on a poster in my eighth grade English class at Alice Deal Junior High School, public high school in Northwest D.C. Mrs. Miles was my English teacher, and I actually spoke on the phone with her a couple days ago to ask her, and I did not remember this, but she says not only did I see the poster, but then I did a presentation on James Baldwin in eighth grade, a biographical presentation where I got dressed up in a suit for some reason and told his whole life story. I have no memory whatsoever of doing that. I just remember seeing his face, seeing his eyes, and being so drawn to him just immediately, the magnetism sort of his persona. And then I borrowed my twin sister's copy of Giovanni's Room the next year in ninth grade and sort of read it in secret. And it wasn't until I got to college that I took a class on James Baldwin at Yale. And we read everything that had been written by him except this children's book. And that led me down a journey to bring it back into print that took about 15 years. I wrote to David Leeming, Baldwin's amazing early biographer and his personal assistant and dear friend. This was 1996. The first email I ever wrote was to David Leeming saying, "Do you know anything about Yaron Kazak?" This French artist, collaborator of Baldwin's, he said, "I never met him. I don't know anybody alive who did, and I'm pretty sure that he's dead." So 4 years later in New York, getting my PhD, in 2003, I sent a bunch of emails to art historians in Paris. "Do you know anything about Yaron Kazak? He's this French artist, probably deceased." I leave my phone number. 3 months later, the phone rings in my studio apartment in Brooklyn. It's Yaron Kazak calling from France saying, "I'm alive. Come to Paris. I have many stories to tell you about Jimmy."
I really must press you a little further on this one, because it has to be extraordinary in many ways for someone who looks how you look to be as entranced, shall we say, by someone who looks like James Baldwin looked. Might there perhaps have been some element of seeing yourself in him and his writing that facilitated your draw to him?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I grew up in D.C. At this point, the public school was majority African American. I was one of the few white students in the school. My father was a civil rights attorney. I grew up around Marion Wright Edelman, and her husband was a godfather to my sister and things like that. So I was surrounded by civil rights discourse from a very, very young age. But in Baldwin, I found somebody who was both speaking to that discourse, but also speaking to questions of sexuality. So even though I was not out in junior high school and high school and not until college, seeing him gave language, right, for both of these aspects of my lived experience. I saw parts of myself in him, as many, I think many of us do, right, when you read James Baldwin. But the biographer must never make the mistake of over-identifying, right, with their subject, I believe. You have to keep, even if you adore their writing and their work and find them fascinating, you have to try to keep some distance, I believe, in order to do justice to their lives.
Certainly, as I was reading your book, I found so many parallels, not to my life, living through the time that he had already been through, but was writing about in the past, and remembering those events and those experiences and those feelings. It brought smiles and tears and lots of reflections. It is not something I wanted to read quickly, because it brought up so much that was pertinent. It just seemed likely that that was part of what was real for you, too. So did you have, in the process of going deeper into someone whose life you had already become quite familiar with, did you have any revelations about James Baldwin as the subject, or perhaps about the writing process about James Baldwin?
I had many revelations about James Baldwin throughout the writing of it and the writing process. I mean, this was not a biography to begin with. It only became a biography. I mean, remember, this happened back in the 90s, in the early 2000s. At that point, Baldwin hadn't sort of resurged in popularity. And I also didn't think I was capable of writing a biography. I was really, my goal was to get Little Man back into print and to tell this little story, this snippet, this small, what I thought was a small part of his life. But the revelation for me, as I went over and interviewed Joran Kozak and Joran Kozak's wife, Beatrice Kozak, I started to discover that there were all these gaps in our understanding of Baldwin's life. Here's Baldwin, a writer who wrote about love relentlessly, right, in his nonfiction and in his fiction. And yet we knew very, very little about his love life, right? And I mean love, his love life in a capacious sense, not just who were his romantic partners, but who did he love, who sustained him, what kinds of relationships inspired him as an artist, as a writer, as an activist. Even Buford Delaney, who is his mentor, you know, very important throughout his life, but really changed his life when he was 16. If you go back to the excellent documentary, The Price of the Ticket, that came out in the 80s, so it's such an important documentary. There's no Buford Delaney in it. If you go to Raoul Peck's really important documentary, there's no Buford Delaney in it, right? The revelation for me then was structural, because I understood that I was writing a biography, but I was writing a biography that was structured through these four relationships. Buford Delaney, then Lucien Hapersberger, who's his great love, who he dedicated Giovanni's Room to, Engin Cezar, the Turkish actor who he met in Greenwich Village and then followed him to Istanbul in the 60s to kind of escape all the trials and tribulations of the civil rights movement. He wrote The Fire Next Time there. He finished Another Country there. He had to get away from all of the politics in order to comment back on what was happening in the United States. And then finally, Joran Kozak, who had completely disappeared from, you know, the archives around Baldwin. It turns out that he was his last great love. He dedicated If Beale Street Could Talk to him. That's a black heterosexual love story, but in some ways it's inspired by this interracial transatlantic love affair. So Baldwin was so layered and so complicated, and the only way to get to all those layers, I felt, was to start to look at these relationships more closely.
Two things have come out of what you just said that I want to ask you about. One of them is you're keeping track of 4, 5, 6, maybe 10 different relationships and the ways in which they reveal themselves in writing or in conversation. How do you keep track of so many supposedly separate trains of thought as a researcher, writer, particularly as they pertain to the storyline that you were developing? What was your system for doing that?
A lot of my friends are visual artists, and I've spent a lot of time at artist residencies writing, McDowell, where James Baldwin went, and Yaddo and other ones. And usually the writers just show up with their computers, and then all the visual artists show up with, you know, trucks full of canvases and paints and all of that. I would show up like them because I would be bringing massive paper archives with me and all of hardcovers of Baldwin's books that I'd already marked up and massive archives that in my own interviews, but others that I printed out. So my method was the only way that I could make this book happen and imagine how it could be written was to sort of act like a visual artist, and I would request an artist studio. And I would have the huge, big canvas, and I would storyboard, basically. My first move would be to storyboard a section. Now, everything would get moved around, because Baldwin lived this, he was a transatlantic commuter, as he called himself. So to map his travels across the globe would be this insane crisscrossing, right? And there are letters, and some have dates, and some don't. And so a lot of time was spent just figuring out where the heck he was when these things were happening and when he was writing, and cross-checking with, if it didn't have a date, you'd have to read the letter to see what was happening in it. And so I would spend hours sort of almost creating a canvas of his life visually before I was able to even start writing. I won't lie, it was exciting in some ways, but it was also a very tedious process, as most biographers can confirm.
Yeah, I was just imagining as I was reading, okay, so if I were writing this, how would I keep track of this? And I thought about linear can't work very well, but it didn't dawn on me until you just said it that the perfect way to do it is visually.
It was the only way, and I took pictures of some of it. I wish I'd taken more, but I remember when I was writing it thinking, Nick, remember how you did this, even just like what in the order, like when you went to the archives and when you storyboarded, and when you figured out, because I was quoting from his letters, I was quoting from his published fiction and nonfiction, I was using the nonfiction and to understand the fiction, and so it just became almost second nature after a while. You know, once you'd done it, sort of, it just became part of my own DNA. And by the time I got into sort of a third of into writing the book, that's when it finally clicked. I rewrote the whole first third of the book because I didn't find the voice and the structure until he landed in Paris, much as he didn't really find himself and his writing until he went to Paris. It was as soon as he landed in Paris, I wrote the scene where he's in a bar called La Reine Blanche, a gay bar on Saint-Germain, and he meets Lucien Happersberger for the first time. And when I started writing that, suddenly I felt like I'd found my footing. I'd found the way I wanted to tell the story.
Which brings up the second thing, the need, perhaps, to visit any and or all of the places that you were writing about that he experienced. What was that like for you?
It was really tough to have to visit the south of France and Corsica and Istanbul and, you know, Paris. Like, it was really rough. No, I thank BIO because it was a Bob and Ina Cairo Award that allowed me to travel to Corsica, which I think I'm the first Baldwin biographer to have gone to this, where he spent 7 consecutive months in the 50s. It was there that he was recovering from a breakup with an important lover of his, Arnold, where he contemplated suicide very seriously, which was a running theme throughout his life. Mm-hmm. And I took my mother with me to Corsica on this trip, and she helped me. We went down to the town hall, and we managed to find the house where he had stayed. We went out there. It was July. It was so hot out. And we went and knocked on the door, and nobody answered. And I was trying to do the Bob Caro thing. I really admire Bob Caro. So I was thinking, turn every page, go to every place so you can write the scene. But it was so hot out, so we knocked on the door. We decided to walk down towards the water because Baldwin had jumped off of a balcony, sort of a terrace, in order to walk down to the water one night where he was seriously considering ending his life. So we're walking down, and we look back, and on the terrace is a woman doing laundry. And so, intrepid biographer that I do, what do you think I did? I jumped behind a tree. But my mother said, "Bonjour." So up we went into the house that had not changed since he'd lived there. We spent the entire day having a tour. They were the second owners after the person who'd owned it when he was there. Heard all the stories. So when I write about Corsica and his time there, I'm able to really envision it. And I told this story at a Caro Award, so I'm being a little bit redundant, but I turned to Bob and I said, "So, you know, you're right. You have to turn every page and you have to visit everywhere. But also, Bob, always bring your mother."
I can relate to that. So many times you refer in the book to, I think I'm quoting here, directly into the tortured heart of white American masculinity. How did you relate to that concept, and what may you have learned about yourself as a white American male?
I learned everything through Baldwin about white American masculinity and how pernicious it can be for everyone, including white men, including myself. I mean, part of what he taught me was how my repression, you know, of my own desires was eating me up inside, which is, I think, true, whether they're sexual desires or other forms of relating that is destroying white people in this country. So that's something that I learned early, but it was, you know, reading Stranger in the Village was life-changing for me because I always felt different growing up somewhat, but also even at my school. So at my junior high school, I was the only white kid on the basketball team. And I had a nickname that I never understood until I read James Baldwin's Stranger in the Village. My nickname was Politics. And at first I thought, well, my father's sort of involved in DC politics, like maybe that's what it is. No, in a good-hearted way, saying, you are the political hire here. You were hired onto this basketball team because coach felt there needed to be one white player, right? So that to me was a big moment. And when James Baldwin said, you know, at the end of that essay, the world is white no longer, and it will never be white again, it really resonated.
At some point, and I wasn't able to find it when I searched after the fact, not having made note of it at the time, there's a quote that you say, something is referred to in a truly literary work. And I thought, my immediate thought was, what does that mean? What is a truly literary work, and how does that show up in the work you did?
I remember writing that phrase, and I believe the context there is just how ahead of his time he was to be writing Giovanni's Room, right, in the 50s, to be writing a homosexually themed novel. I wouldn't call it a homosexual novel because he wouldn't call it that, right? But that at that period, I mean, you had Truman Capote, you had Gore Vidal, but there was just very little that was being written that was considered literature. It might be like pulp novels and stuff like that. So the fact that he was writing about homosexuality at that time was so groundbreaking and so brave of him, right? He was also writing about race in that book. I mean, even though it was narrated by a white, closeted gay man, people say, oh, he wasn't writing about race. No, he was. He was writing about whiteness as a race. He was writing about, right, the racism, the sort of internalized homophobia, and the way that racism comes out of this kind of self-hatred that David experienced. So he was to be writing about queerness or homosexuality and race in the same book in a highly literary work was just groundbreaking for that time.
One way of interpreting that statement about what is literary is the ways in which Baldwin shifted the voice of what it was he was writing about to be someone other than what he was writing about, which takes it out of the personal and takes it into the universal, because it was no less true. Does that resonate in any way?
You know, a lot of times if you ask a fiction writer, how autobiographical is your work, they'll really bristle and say, oh no. You know, even though the book is has a character that grew up exactly where they grew up, had the same experience, very similar experiences. And of course, I respect that. Every writer has the right to, you know, that's their work. But Baldwin wasn't like that. Baldwin never was not coy about anything like that. He always said, oh, yeah, John Grimes, that was John Grimes, you know, and asked parts of David from Giovanni's Room, that's me. And that Just Above My Head was in many ways a continuation of these ideas and characters that were part of himself. So I really admired that about him. I mean, he was very honest about that, and he was also very honest about the distinction between truth and fiction. Even as he talk about the blending of autobiography and fiction, you know, you think of something like Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, right, which was called nonfiction, but in fact he was making up a lot of it, and he was interior monologues and all of that. Baldwin wouldn't do that. He would write his novels, and he would say they're novels, and then he would write his essays. And you'll notice even in his essays, I mean, he was very aware of the fallibility of memory. So he would write a lot about, he said, much is blotted out, right? But I remember, you remember, for example, being circumcised. You remember being circumcised at a very older age than usual. But he, in that same essay, I think that was No Name in the Street, you know, he writes about how he doesn't trust his memory. And so when he was asked late in life why he didn't write a quote-unquote autobiography, that's what he said, I don't trust my memory. But of course, his whole corpus really is kind of his autobiography.
And the subtitle of your biography is Baldwin, A Love Story. As you're talking, I'm also struck by the fact that although Baldwin wrote in several different genres, the theme that he was writing about was, as you subtitled your book,
it was always love. He was writing in the realm of fiction. Actually, these are all love stories. I mean, even Gotel in the Mountain is a love story between John and Elisha, and a kind of falling out of love or struggle with love for God. Giovanni's Room, that's a love story. Another Country, I mean, this is these tortured, you know, liaisons and love affairs of black and white Americans in that period. And Beale Street Could Talk is, you know, now a classic love story. Just Above My Head is an incredible novel of love between brothers, you know. Love between family members. So love is everywhere in the fiction, but love is everywhere in the nonfiction, too. I mean, he's saying in The Fire Next Time, you know, black and white Americans must love each other, like siblings, like brothers, right? He said that in his letter to his nephew. You know, he really thought that love was the only hope for American reconciliation of some sort. You know, of course, love takes off the masks. We know all the buzzwords that we hear now on social media, that the great quotes that he has. But we need to go deeper, you know, we need to go deeper into what that meant and how he lived it, you know. He really lived, he was full of love for his family and for his friends and his collaborators, Richard Avedon, Jorn Kazak, full of love for Lorraine Hansberry, for Toni Morrison. I mean, I think it's important to stress, even though this book focuses on these four men, that Baldwin was incredibly close to many, many women, many black women, many white women. Mary Painter was his best friend in Paris. The letters between them are extraordinary. He was very close, you know, to Toni Morrison. I found a photo for it I wasn't able to include in the book, but there's this beautiful photo of them together in St. Paul de Vence, holding hands, smiling, and they both just look happy. And I think it's important to remember that, too. I mean, there can be this tragic narrative that's sometimes applied to Baldwin's life, which I think is unfair. You know, people, oh, he never found true love, or, He had such a hard life and all of this. James Baldwin had a lot of fun, okay? That's clear from these letters. And if you talk to people who knew him, you know, who knew him well, he knew he had a good time in his life. And it's important to remember that as well.
I am hopeful that the publication of your book will introduce those aspects of Baldwin's life to a generation that only knows of him as someone who had an interview with Nikki Giovanni or with William Buckley, or who've never really read him, but whose lives are exhibiting the same themes and the same desires and the same passions that his did. So if nothing else, I find myself wanting to gift someone, you must read this, because it will show you that you are he and he is you, and this may help you feel better about yourself.
I love that. The book is dedicated, of course, to my parents, because it's my first book, and I want to make sure they're here to know how much I appreciate, you know, their support throughout the writing of this book and throughout my life. But it's also dedicated to my three godchildren in Harlem. Elizabeth Hines is their mother, and Carol Jenkins, the journalist, is their grandmother. And I went to college with Elizabeth, and she came with me on many of these research trips as well. So always bring your mother, and also always bring one of your best friends. But they live in a building right by the Ralph Ellison statue in Harlem. So they're now in their teens, and the twins are a little bit younger. But I just knew right away that I wanted to dedicate this book to them. It felt like I want this book to be one that speaks to across generations and that has a life, you know, well beyond my own, I hope.
And so it shall, I'm certain. So you refer to yourself as, amongst other things, an independent scholar. What are you thinking, if you are available for that process, about what's next for you? After such a monumental, gigantic, shall we say, leap forward, what's next in your biographical or not writer career?
I think I'm going to be busy for the next 6 months or so, but I really love going to artist residencies and writing, so I look forward to a chance to go back and jump into the next project. The next project is not a biography per se, but it is life writing. It's partially a memoir, it's partially a social history, and it's somewhat about my gay uncle in New York, who was part of ACT UP, and he was part of the generation that was decimated by the AIDS epidemic. He was HIV positive, but he did not die that way. He actually took his own life on his 60th birthday. So he lived in an apartment in the East Village on Thompson Square Park that was $80 a month that he moved into in the late 70s. And he had an incredible life. I mean, I won't go into it, but you know, Edmund White, we just lost Edmund White. He died the last couple of days. So my uncle had a bunch of claims to fame, but here are two of them. The first is, he was the first, this is what he says, he was the first man in North America to have liposuction of the thighs. And number two, he slept with Diane von Furstenberg and Edmund White on the same day. So that's just a little bit of a teaser, but it's really a book about my own coming of age in D.C. I was a child soprano opera singer at the Kennedy Center, a professional boy soprano. In the 80s, during, you know, coming into my own understanding with all this death and hysteria surrounding me, and then I had this sort of fabulous gay uncle in New York. Anyway, I ended up in 1999 moving into that apartment, that $80 a month apartment for a brief period. And so the book really just crosses, it sort of explores both of our lives and this sort of this crossover that happened before he left. And it also reflects on kind of the gentrification of the East Village, a particular block where he lived, and the history of gay writing about AIDS.
You just raised another topic that I have to ask about. As a musician, you were a boy soprano. Are you still using music? Are you still experiencing music in your life in some special ways?
Not at all. And the reason for that is part of what the book is about. It's why the last time I ever sang, ironically enough, was Silent Night at the Kennedy Center Christmas concert. And then I went silent, and a lot of it was shame around fear, the fear that I would grow up to be gay and be like my uncle. So I stopped singing completely.
I'm in a choir now, and we had the hardest time attracting male singers. And the choir director has spoken of the fact that this is endemic to choir directing all over the country that he knows of. Men don't reveal themselves in the singing world.
Except in the shower they do, don't they?
And yet, it strikes me that the root of that is the same thing that you write about, and that Baldwin wrote about, this inability to experience one's emotional self, and not just to experience, but to express one's feelings, to touch.
That's
without it being considered a sexual phenomenon.
Baldwin was an excellent singer himself. When I went to Paris to interview Joran Kozak for the first time in 2003, we had a dinner and he had friends over and he showed me pictures of them together when they were younger. And there was the clattering of dishes and everything. And then he went and got a recording of Baldwin singing, "Oh Precious Lord," and he just played it. We were in Montmartre in his house and everyone went quiet. And it was almost like Baldwin was there with us. And I just wanted to add to that, one thing that's been so exciting about finishing this book is listening to the audio that's being made by Ron Butler. When he reads from this book, he moves seamlessly between the kind of the narrator's voice, like I guess my voice, the biographer's voice. And when I quote from Baldwin, he dips into Baldwin's voice and it sounds just like James Baldwin. And it's really quite amazing to hear. I you know, to hear my own book read that way was just mind-blowing. And I thought, Ron Butler, can you go on book tour for me? So I'm excited for people to have access to the audiobook as well.
Perfect. And this has really been a delight.
For me as well. Thank you so much.
That was biographer Nicholas Boggs speaking with Carolyn Van Putten about Baldwin, A Love Story. It was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in August 2025. This interview was recorded on June 6th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. during BIO's annual conference. To learn more about BIO or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a great day.